So the history of the church, we spent some time talking about why we should care, why we should be interested. We spent some time talking about how we look at this. So now we're looking at some foundational stuff. So the first foundational stuff that I want to be talking about here is foundations that come from Judaism, because Christianity comes out of the Jewish tradition. Jesus was born a Jew. So that's a place for us to begin, because the whole Old Testament heritage leaves a big mark on us and leaves a big mark on the way that we think about what we do. So one of the fundamental things about the Jewish heritage that we have is the issue of messianic prophecy. The Old Testament is filled with prophecy. And so when you think about, Christianity, we are the people of the fulfilled prophecy. We look to the Old Testament and say, all these things are fulfilled in Jesus. And so many of these things are specifically about him. And so they're about the Messiah specifically. But think about it this way. In the Psalms, in Isaiah, in Zephaniah, the Messiah is a conquering king who will be powerful, who will defeat his enemies, who will reestablish the kingdom with power. In Zechariah, there is a coming king of Zion, but he is humble. He comes riding on a donkey. And he treats people with some grace. In the Psalms and in Micah, the Messiah, the messianic figure, is the great shepherd. The great shepherd of the sheep. In Ezekiel and Daniel, the messianic figure is the Son of Man, which is capitalized because it's a title. And in Ezekiel and Daniel, it's not particularly clear what the title really means, but it is made very clear that this is an important title, and this is a title of a figure who is to come, who is a major, major part of the story. Isaiah, of course, has a long section about the suffering servant. By his stripes we are healed. Hosea talks about he who will come, who is the Redeemer. Genesis and also Psalm 110 talk about Melchizedek, the heir, the priest, who will be like Melchizedek, who will fulfill the priestly role that Melchizedek fulfilled for Abram. Amos promises that he who is to come will be the heir of David. He will be a lineal heir to David the king, and he will restore the Davidic kingdom and the Davidic line. Zechariah says, he who is to come will be the righteous branch. And Jews in the New Testament era were certain that based on these and many other things that are in the Old Testament, that a prophet like Moses would return. That someone would return who would fulfill what Moses did. So messianic prophecy is core to the Jewish way of thinking. It's core to the way that the Jews perceived the world. And it's something that was in the air at the time that Jesus was born in Bethlehem. But there was pretty much nobody who thought that all these different people from the Old Testament would be fulfilled by one person. Most Jews thought that these different figures were some collection of different people, and the Messiah was some of these things, but that the other things were other people who would do other stuff. There really was no one at the time of the New Testament who had come to the conclusion in the Jewish culture that the Messiah would be all these things. that he would be the Son of Man and the Son of David and the humble king and the conquering king and the suffering servant and the redeemer and a priest like Melchizedek, the righteous branch, that all those things could possibly be fulfilled in one person. That was countercultural. That was different. Nobody at that time was writing or thinking or saying that this would be the way that it would occur. And so it's important to realize that, you know, for Jewish people, for the Jews, part of the challenge of thinking about the Messiah, for those who believed that a Messiah was coming, was to try to understand which of these various things the Messiah would actually be. Which of these things applied? What does it mean to be Messiah? What, out of all these things, what applies? But there was no one who had come to the conclusion that all these things will be fulfilled in one. So, but the Jews invented the idea of a messianic perspective. The Jews invented the idea that there's a Messiah coming, and the coming Messiah will do great and glorious things. The coming Messiah will redeem us. He will save us. He will do the things that we think of as the Messiah. That's an idea that comes out of Judaism, and it doesn't come from anywhere else. There's no other ancient tradition about, you know, a coming Messiah, about someone coming to form those kinds of to fulfill those kinds of functions, to fulfill that calling, and so we see the call, you know, about the anointed one, the redeemer, all that. That's a very Jewish idea. It doesn't come from somewhere else, and so all of our perspective about the Messiah, the foundations of our perspective about the idea that there would be a Messiah, that there needed to be a Messiah, that a Messiah is core to redemption and to our lives, is a thing that comes solely from Judaism. So that's the first thing. Second thing was, you know, last week I promised to explain to you how the Jews invented time. So next slide. So this is a sundial, right? This sundial is between 3.5 and 4.5 millennia old. The stick is new, right? Because the old stick didn't last. But the actual stone piece was carved at least 3.5 millennia ago, and probably longer ago, probably by the Sumerians. You know, the society that preceded the society that Abram is called out of in Genesis chapter 12. So, you know, a sundial is something that you can still think of today. You know, you still buy one, find one. You know, it's a nice thing for your garden. You know, Pauline and I were on a little trip recently, and we saw a sundial, and I went to check to see if it was accurate, but here's the thing about this sundial, and here's why the sundial is an idea that really fits in the ancient world. Think about the shape. What's true? What does the shape imply? What does it tell you? It's true about a circle. What did they teach you in geometry class when you were in second grade about a circle? Okay. One of the things that they should have taught you was that a circle doesn't have a beginning and it doesn't have an end. It doesn't, right? Where's the beginning? Where's the end? There isn't a beginning. There isn't an end. It just keeps going round and round and round. This is the way the ancients thought about time. This is the way the ancients thought about a day, that it was a circle that didn't really have a beginning or an end. It just went around And that each day was the same. You get the same cycle. Sun comes up in the east every day around the same time. It gets a little earlier, and then it gets a little later, and then it gets a little earlier, and then it gets a little later. But the sun comes up at the same time, tracks across the sky in the same way, goes down in the west. It's predictable. The cycle is the same every day. Around it goes, around and around. What do they think about a year? It's a circle, and it goes around. Because they thought it was a circle, this is true of the Mayas, the Incas, the Aztecs, this is true of any ancient civilization, any pre-Jewish exposure kind of civilization thought of time as a circle with no beginning and no end. That means that every day is basically the same. That the only day that matters is today. Because yesterday is long gone and tomorrow is unknowable, not understandable. That this year is the same as last year. We're doing laps around the same track. That's the ancient perspective on time, which means the time is just a circle, it's a cycle. And what does that mean about your life? It means that your life is meaningless because you just get on the circle and you go round and round and round until you fall off. And that's it. The Jews changed that. We don't think of time that way. You don't think of time that way. In the ancient world, there was no real reason to give years a number, because they were all the same. And it was believed that only, you know, really successful kings or hugely heroic figures lived lives that mattered and had any echoes at all. The Sumerians have given us one piece of literature that has survived for more than 3.5 millennia. It's called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And Gilgamesh is a great Sumerian king who may or may not have actually ever existed, who does mighty, mighty things and lives for, you know, thousands of years or something. But in the Epic of Gilgamesh, other than Gilgamesh's enemies, nobody in the Epic of Gilgamesh matters except for Gilgamesh. Lots of people come and go. Lots of people are born and died, and they don't matter. Their lives make no difference whatsoever. They're you know, Star Trek guys in red shirts. They don't have names, and they're just here to get shot at some dramatic point and be gone and forgotten. You know, on Star Trek, you know, when the guy in the red shirt gets shot, there's not like a funeral or memorial service, and nobody's even like sad. They didn't have a name to begin with. He wasn't a person. He was just a person, you know, just a red guy that gets shot, right? You know, so that was a Star Trek trope for years. But in the ancient world, it's like everybody is a Star Trek guy with a red shirt, and then everybody is totally a disposable life that means nothing. That's this. That's the way of thinking about time in the ancient world. So, next slide. So, I do hope you've read this. Okay. This is Winnie the Pooh, by the way, in case you're not acquainted. But Pooh says, "What day is it?" Piglet says, "It's today." And Pooh says, "That's my favorite day." Winnie the Pooh, sees time like the ancients. There's only today. Not really any yesterday, there's not really any tomorrow. There's just today. Now, what's the story that goes with this picture? You didn't know you were going to get quizzed on Winnie the Pooh this morning, did you? So you didn't read ahead. You didn't practice. What's wrong? Anyway, so anybody remember the story? So Winnie the Pooh is walking on a snowy day, right? And he goes out in the woods, and he's on a path that curves around to the right. And eventually he comes to a place where there's footprints that come in and follow the path. And what's his conclusion about that? Somebody's out here. I'm going to follow them. And so he's following these footprints, and his friend Piglet comes along and says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I'm following these footprints." Piglet says, "You think it's going to be dangerous?" "I don't know." "Well, let's go see." So they're following the footprints, the two of them. And then they come to a place where a second set of footprints seems to join this set of footprints that they're following. And then a smaller set of footprints joins. And then they have this conversation about, this is getting dangerous because look at how many people we're following. What's going on? They're going in a circle and they're following their own footsteps, right? That's the ancient world. You go round and round and round, and it doesn't mean anything. That's the mindset. When you read Genesis and you're reading about Abraham coming out of Ur and getting sent, go, that's the thing that Abraham has been raised up in. That's the culture that he's been surrounded by. That's the people that he's been surrounded by. That's where his whole life has been built around the idea that you just go round and round and round until you fall off and you're dead. The Jews didn't think of time that way. The Jews invented the concept of time. So, have you ever played when you were in school, did you do a timeline? When you were second, third grade, you did a timeline, right? In fifth grade, you had to do a timeline, okay? A timeline assumes what? There's a beginning and there's an end. It's not a circle. A timeline is straight. The Jews invented the idea that there's a beginning, Genesis, a creation, a beginning point, that the line has a spot at which it begins. And there's an end, apocalypse. There's a point at which it will all come to an end, at which it will be done. That's a Jewish idea. And every time you buy a calendar that has a different number than the calendar you bought last year, you're doing a Jewish thing. Every time you wake up in the morning and you think today is different than yesterday in some meaningful way, you're doing a Jewish thing. Every time you think that life has a beginning and an end, you're doing a Jewish thing. The Jews invented that concept of time. They're the only people out of the ancient world that thought that there was a beginning and an end. And because they thought there was a beginning and an end, they thought that individual lives mattered, that they filled some spot along the way that was significant, building towards something. And so Jews thought about time and about people in radically different ways than the culture that was around them. Their concept of time caused them to think that people as individuals matter, that today matters because it connects to tomorrow, and tomorrow is a real thing. Next year is a real thing. Next year isn't just a do-over of this year. It's not just the same trip around the circle, but it's different. And so that's a Jewish idea. We are heirs to that. So, next slide. So, what about God? The ancient gods, and you studied some Greek mythology back in the day. Okay. What are some things that are true about Greek, the Greek gods, the Greek pantheon, the Greek conception of what a god is like? Zeus and Aphrodite and all those. If you watch Disney's Hercules, you get a little taste of this maybe in goofy animated form. But the Greeks, like all ancient people, believed in gods who basically didn't care about you or me, because they were busy with their own business. And gods who were very difficult to know. You couldn't personally know them. Getting a relationship with them was very difficult and not something that they were interested in anyway. And ancient gods were almost always regarded as impulsive. They just did stuff. They did random stuff. They got offended about this, and so they went off that way. This happened, so they did this thing. And they were regarded as being driven by relatively human impulses. Mythology, whether you're talking about the Greeks or the Norwegians, you know, all these different strands of ancient mythologies, the gods get offended at one another, at what humans do, at stuff, and they lash out. Disastrous stuff happens because gods are upset about stuff that irritated them. Gods are a little childlike in that concept because the gods are easily offended, and, you know, when they do, they act like six-year-olds. So, also, in the ancient world, gods are mostly local. They are connected to a particular time or a particular place or a particular family. These are my family gods. These are our gods for this city. These are our gods for this community. And if I go someplace else, if I go down to Egypt, they will have different gods. And I won't know those gods at all. And I will have to find out about those gods because I might take my family gods with me, but the other gods stay here because they live here. They live at Delphi. They live, you know, at Valhalla, which is, you know, north. Yeah. So the Jews said, no, that's not a way to think about, that's not the way that it is. You know, I talked a couple of weeks ago about Zoroastrianism. You know, 2,600 years ago, Zoroaster lives and he proposes a thing which becomes, 2 millennia ago, probably the largest religion in the world. And still has, 100,000 or so adherents for reasons that are really difficult to understand. But Zoroaster's proposal in Zoroastrianism is that God is not knowable. God is distant. You can't know God. You can't connect to God. You can't understand God. That's the fundamental idea of God in Zoroastrianism. Jews didn't believe that. Jews believed in God who creates, God who acts, God who initiates, God who is knowable, God who connects to people and speaks to individuals, God who works in individuals' lives, a God who is not offended because you did something irritated, but a God who has a consistent sense, these things are sin and these things are not. And enforces a consistent standard that is not capricious, it is not in the moment, it is a larger standard that applies in every time, in every place. That God is not limited. He is not bound by time or place. He is the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but that doesn't limit him to that. He is not limited in some way. The Jews invented a very different way of thinking about God, which is foundational to the way that we think about God. We are heirs to the Jewish tradition, and the Jewish tradition with respect to God is totally different than anything else in the ancient world. And then, you know, this issue of Messiah, apocalypse, the issue of, you know, what kind of Messiah will come, what kind of thing will happen at the end. Jews believed in these things, but they couldn't agree on these things. Okay? When you think about the big group, Sadducees, Pharisees, Essenes, and Zealots, that were the big threads of Judaism in the time of the New Testament, there's no agreement on who the Messiah is. There's no agreement on what kind of Messiah there will be. There's no agreement on whether there will be a resurrection. There is no agreement about what kind of apocalypse there will be. But there is agreement that all these things are important things and they're all worth debating and arguing about and fighting about. And at least in some cases, killing each other about. Because they're important. And so Sadducees had decided that, yeah, the resurrection thing, that's not really supposed to be true. So they didn't believe in the resurrection anymore. But the Pharisees believed that it's absolutely true. There absolutely will be a resurrection. So the Pharisees believed that there would be a Messiah, and the Messiah would be like a Pharisee, coincidentally enough. That the Messiah would be a person who would fulfill the law in every respect. Zealots believed that there would be a Messiah, and the Messiah would be a conquering king who would whack the Romans and whack the Greeks and conquer and make Israel great again. So these things were big parts of the Jewish perspective, but they were things that that there was very little agreement about. So how about this? Look at Luke chapter 16, verse 13. This is a fundamentally Jewish way of talking, arguing, and thinking. Now, Luke isn't Jewish. He's not really writing to a Jewish audience. But he spent some years trailing around with Paul, whose perspective is very Jewish and whose rhetoric is very Jewish. And he spent a lot of time with the, apparently, with at least some of the 12 disciples as he's been doing his research to write this this gospel. And so he writes this in a Jewish way. Look at the construction of this. No man can serve two masters, bracketed by you cannot serve God and mammon. There's the two masters, right? Either he will hate the one, despise the other. Love the one, love the other, be devoted to the one. This is a very Jewish way of building rhetoric, building a thought, building an argument. Builds to a point and then builds back to where it started. This has a beginning and an ending. So, next slide. Isaiah 28, verses 14 through 18. Therefore, hear the word of the Lord, you scoffers who rule this people in Jerusalem, because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with Sheol we have made an agreement. When the overwhelming whip passes through, it will not come to us. There's an establishment of a covenant. For we have made lies our refuge, and in falsehood we have taken shelter. Refuge and shelter. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, behold, I am the one who has laid a foundation in Zion, a stone, a tested stone, a precious cornerstone of a sure foundation. Let's talk about building. Whoever believes not will not be in haste. That's the inscription that goes on the cornerstone. And I'll make justice the line and righteousness the plumb line. I'm back to building. And hail will sweep away the refuge of lies, and waters will overwhelm the shelter. There's no refuge. There's no shelter. Then your covenant with death will be annulled, and your agreement with Sheol will not stand. While the overwhelming scourge passes through, you will be beaten down by it. It's a Jewish way of thinking. It's a Jewish way of talking. It's a construction. And the Bible does this over and over and over and over again. You know, anybody who tells you that, you know, oh, the New Testament was written by, you know, Greek-speaking people, you know, in the second century or something. No, it wasn't. You know, Luke chapter 4, same construction. This is the way the Jews think and Jews talk. You know, Luke chapter 4, verse 16, beginning of verse 16, you know this story. Think about the way this is set up. This isn't just a chronicle of something that happened. This is built in a very specific way. He came to Nazareth where he'd been brought up, and as was his custom, he went to the synagogue on the Sabbath day. Okay? And he stood up to read. And the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll, found the place where it was written. The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant, and he sat down, and the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. It's Jewish. It's a Jewish way of thinking. It's a Jewish way of writing. It's a progression. You progress to a climax, and then you work back to the beginning. The climax here is sight. Sight to the blind. That's the climax. That's the point. He comes in. He stands up. He's given the book. He unrolls the scroll. He talks about, I've been called to preach those who are sent. I've been sent to bring freedom. This will result in sight, sight to the blind. So I've been sent to bring freedom, and so I proclaim. So he rolled up the scroll and gave it back and sat down in the synagogue. That's a rhetorical construction that, you know, that didn't happen because Luke just was like writing and it just occurs. That happens because Luke has had in his head that the people that surround me, this is the way that they think. This is the way that they write. This is the way they tell a story. This is a fundamentally Jewish way of telling a story. This is your Bible. And you're reading Jewish thinking every time you read anything in the Bible that's constructed like this. And so much stuff is. So, a few things about rhetoric. Keeping in mind that, you know, the chapter and verse notations here are not inspired. Okay? They're not from God, right? The chapters were added around AD 350. We probably blame Jerome for the chapters. And some of his chapter divisions don't make any sense. Some of them, you know, the break is at the wrong spot, famously. The verse numbers don't come until basically the era of the Reformation. So, you know, the 1500s sometime, 1550s. Something like that. That's where you get the verse number. So remember that, you know, for three quarters of the history of the New Testament, there weren't any verse numbers. Okay? We like the verse numbers. They help us find stuff, but they're not inspired by God. Okay? And people have been reading the Bible for hundreds and hundreds of years without them. Okay? And people in the first century did not read Paul's letters and think that they were in chapters. They didn't read the Gospels and think they were in chapters. You know, somebody in the second century, if you said, hey, you know, in Matthew 28, they're like, what are you talking about? I know Matthew's Gospel, but 28 what? Okay. So that's some Jewish stuff. So Jewish stuff is foundational to who we are as Christians. And when we think about the church, these things are part of what we experience today in the way that we think, in the way that we work, in the way that we engage the world today. So what about the Greeks? The New Testament era is this super fascinating, to those of us who care about this sort of stuff, confluence of three very distinct major cultures flowing together. And so one of those three, of course, the second of those three, beyond the Jewish culture, is the Greek culture. So, keeping in mind that the Greek culture of this era is fundamentally driven by the idea of philosophy. Philosophy is the basis for thinking and debate. It's the basis for coming up with ideas. It's the basis for understanding the world. Philosophy is the ongoing search for truth and understanding. When Paul comes to Athens in Acts, he gets invited to the Areopagus. The Areopagus is the famous outdoor debating society of Athens, and it's basically a philosophical society. And it's the most respected forum in all of Athens, and really all of Greece, in which to debate any topic. And the rules of the Areopagus are philosophical. You use philosophical ways to think about what it is that you're talking about. And so when Paul speaks to the Areopagus, it sounds really different than the stuff that he says in other places that he goes, because he's speaking to an audience that is steeped in philosophy. Keep in mind that, you know, Socrates and Plato and Aristotle have already been there and have already written their stuff and have already left their mark on Greek culture. And so the Greeks of the New Testament era are people that know the story of Socrates. They know the way that Socrates thought. They know the Socratic method of using questions as a way to find the truth. They've read some Plato. They've been exposed to Plato. Plato's big ideas are really important to the Greeks. Plato is the first of the Greeks to really get at the idea, and this became a fundamental thing the Greeks were really focused on. They had the difference between, that there's some difference between matter, between the physical things that we see and touch, and spirit. And we can't see and touch the spirit. And so Plato goes into this whole thing about the Platonic forms, which is really weird, at least that's what I think, okay? But Plato is using that as a way to try to get at this difference between matter and spirit. And this is fundamental to the way that Greeks think. And so when you see people coming and preaching the gospel in Greek context, the Christian perspective that there is a body and a spirit gets at this Greek thing about there's matter and spirit, and we are really trying to understand how they fit together, how they work. Plato, of course, one of his most famous images was the cave, right? So Plato's cave was the proposal. Plato said, look, maybe your life is like as if you were chained in a cave. There's a cave, and the cave bends around, and you're chained to the wall. So you can't see out the cave entrance. But you can see on the back wall of the cave shadows from the light, the sunlight outside, shining on people standing in the cave entrance. You can see those shadows playing on the back of the cave. And if you've never been out of the cave and never had an opportunity to look out of the cave, you think the shadows are real. You think they're what life really is. You think that's what's really going on. Well, when you come and share the gospel with somebody who's been steeped in that idea, the gospel is the aha that helps to unchain them from the wall of the cave and go see the truth of what life is really like, right? But people in Greek culture were steeped in this idea that maybe the life that we live, we're just looking at shadows and we're not understanding reality. We're not understanding the real truth. So that's a big thing that's running in the background here, these big ideas about philosophy. Aristotle, of course, his fundamental philosophical thing was about virtue, the idea that the thing that defines you is the pursuit of virtue or the failure to pursue virtue. There's certain things that are virtuous and you should pursue those things. So many Greeks were pursuing the idea that I should be a virtuous person by doing the right thing. And of course, when people come to the priest of gospel, say it's not, you know, you don't do the right thing to get right with God, but you get right with God so that you might be able to do the right thing. And so there are things in the Greek philosophical culture that are things that lead to open doors for the gospel and provide a cultural world. So philosophy is really important. The Greeks also have this whole mystery cults thing. This is the foundation of the Gnosticism that plagues the church over the first couple of three centuries and really beyond, the idea that there are secret things, and some people get to know the secrets. And so in the mystery cult of the Greek era, there were mystery cults, and you had to join and pay money, and then they would tell you some of their secrets, and then you had to grow up in it, and they would tell you some more of their secrets, and then grow up more in it, and they would tell you more of their secrets. And that should sound to you like Tom Cruise in Scientology, because it works exactly the same way. That should sound to you a little bit like Mormonism, because it basically works the same way. But this was a big cultural thing, and so people, you know, people that are steeped in this, you know, are the sort of guys, Simon Magus, hey, you know, give me the secrets. I'll pay you money for the secrets. No, in Christianity, we don't do secrets. We tell everybody. It's all out there, right? We don't have, you don't have to be a member to get to a point where you get to see the secrets. We don't do that. But this is a big part of the culture, and it's a big part of the things that in the first couple of centuries of the church, evangelists and others are bumping up against. So, you know, the Greek gods, of course, you know, capricious, self-interested, transactional. You know, the Greek gods are facing the reality that, you know, they're all about, you know, what have you done for me lately kind of stuff is very much the way the Greek gods work, right? So Alexander the Great, Alexander, who is actually of Macedon, so he's not actually technically Greek, right? Macedonia being on the north side of Greece. But Alexander inherits the throne of Macedonia, and which is a relatively small kingdom from his father when his father mysteriously dies at a very convenient moment for Alexander in his life. So not that I want to imply anything untoward, but there it is. And Alexander creates the greatest army the Greeks have ever seen and uses his great army to conquer not only all of Greece, but Asia Minor, the Middle East, and then, you know, into India eventually. Alexander creates a great empire. And, of course, along the way, he keeps founding cities, and, you know, most of the cities that he founds are named Alexandria. He loves that name. And so he founds an Alexandria basically everywhere he goes. But he founds many cities which are planned on a Greek layout, and he does, you know, it's not just about the army. We wouldn't remember Alexander. He wouldn't be called Alexander the Great if he had just been a guy with an army who conquered places. But he brought Greek language. He imposed the Greek language on all the places he went. He imposed Greek culture on all the places he went. He taught Greek philosophy and imposed Greek education every place he went. He founded cities that were built on a Greek model and worked in a Greek way. So he created a basis for a common language and a common culture that encompassed Greece, Asia Minor, Egypt, all the Middle East, and out into Central Asia. And a common language and a common culture makes it easy for big ideas to move. And so Alexander lays a foundation which eventually becomes fundamental to the transmission of the gospel. So, Septuagint. The Old Testament is translated into Greek, which is partly because Alexander has created an environment where everybody needs to speak Greek, and so many Jews have begun to speak Greek that it is necessary for the Jewish scripture to be in Greek. So, allegedly, a group of 70 rabbis gets together and translates the Old Testament into Greek. When Jesus quotes the Old Testament, he quotes the Septuagint, which is at least partly because it's the Old Testament that most Jews at the time were familiar with. That is, at the time, most Jews were familiar with the Old Testament translated into Greek, not the Old Testament in Hebrew. Pharisees mostly spoke Hebrew. Jesus is debating the Pharisees at the temple. There's a good chance he's speaking Hebrew. When Jesus is ministering in Galilee, he is speaking the local language there, which is neither Greek nor Hebrew, right? So we don't know for sure whether Jesus spoke three languages or not, but it's likely that he did. But Judaism takes on, the Septuagint helps the Judaism to take on more and more Greek aspects. The rise of the Hellenistic Jews, which is one of the key parties that you see through the, particularly in the Gospels, Hellenized Jews, Greek-speaking Jews, Jews that not only have learned the Greek language but have taken on Greek cultural aspects, is a key part of the Gospel story. And of course, the last thing about the Greek thing that is really significant here, a couple things. One is the Maccabean Revolt. 200 years before Christ, Judas Maccabeus and his brothers lead a revolt against the Greeks and drive them out. And briefly, Israel is independent again under a Maccabean kingdom. And the temple worship is fully reestablished and all that before the Romans come and conquer the place again. But there's a glimmer of independence there. And the Maccabean Revolt taught people in the New Testament era it was possible to revolt and throw off the occupying authority. So the Zealots, and at least one of the 12 disciples is a Zealot, a revolutionary, are people that believe we can do the same to the Romans that we did to the Greeks 250 years ago. It's possible. So that didn't turn out to be true. When they tried that, the Romans turned out to be a lot more difficult to beat. But think about language. Christ comes from Christos. Christos is a Greek word. Sometimes we talk about ekklesia, which is the Greek word for church. Agape, if you talk about agape love, if you talk about love in the sense of phileo and agape, if you talk about the different kinds of love, those are Greek concepts, that's Greek language. If you talk about the logos, if you talk about Jesus as the logos, the living word, that's Greek. So the Greek culture and the Greek foundation remain something that influences us. The third big influence here is Roman rule, the presence of Romans. Now, people that write about this in the ancient world sometimes talk about Christianity is the integration of Jewish and Greek culture through the instrument of the Romans. that the Romans don't bring much culturally to this. They're just the guys who made it possible. They're the executive producers. So some fun foundational things. When you think about the fact that the gospel comes at a time that the Roman Empire is big and still growing, but it is close to the peak of its size at the time that Jesus is born in Bethlehem. And the Roman world constitutes the entire coastline of the Mediterranean Sea on both the north and the south side at that time, as well as out into the east and north to the Alps and beyond that in some places. But Roman law, Roman culture are unifying and connecting. The Romans have imposed a system of law, which is very Roman, it's not so much Greek at all, and a culture that is mostly Greek. The Romans have basically lifted the Greeks' culture and imposed that across their entire empire and created a common way for dealing with trouble, a common way of thinking, a common set of laws, and a common set of cultural milestones. And you see throughout the book of Acts, Paul is navigating these things and leveraging these things. Paul, unusually at the time, has Roman citizenship. He's born into Roman citizenship. He leverages his Roman citizenship when he is dealing with Roman authorities and when he's dealing with others. It gives him status that he can use. He gets a free trip to Rome because, as a Roman citizen, he can appeal to Caesar. So, keeping in mind that not even 10% of the people in the Roman Empire are citizens. So it's not a usual thing. But Rome is also important for the pagan religion because although the Greeks followed a pagan religion, the Romans kind of institutionalized pagan religion. Pagan religion was supported by the government. It was supported by tax dollars. People were taxed in the Roman Empire, and some of that tax money went to support pagan temples. Pagan religion was not really organized. That is, the temples were independent and worshipped a variety of different gods. But pagan religion was everywhere. It was ever-present. You know, when you're reading 1st and 2nd Corinthians, when you're reading about Paul going to Corinth, you've got to keep in mind that the city of Corinth is dominated by the Acrocorinth, which is the big rocky hill that overlooks the city, and that there's a winding road going up to the top of the Acrocorinth, and all the way up there are pagan temples, and a big one up at the top, that worship various gods. And each of the pagan temples is advertising all the time. So how do they advertise? They have music, and it's loud. They burn incense, a lot of it. They employ attractive young people to provide sexual services to the people that come to worship at the temple. They compete with one another. They host feasts and parties. You don't join a pagan temple. You're not a member of a pagan temple. You go there from time to time. The temples that are popular grow and stay in business. Temples that people are not that are not popular, they go out of business. There's no money. The government gives some money, but it's not enough to keep them going. So pagan worship is really competitive. The temples do parades and stuff in the streets to try to get you to want to come to their things. They promote their activities. They have people walking through the streets shouting about, you know, come to this temple because we're going to do this thing and it's going to be so great. You're going to love it. We're going to have the best food in town, you know. Okay, but that is everywhere. It's ever-present, but it's relatively weak because pagan worship is mostly about what's in it for me. People go to the pagan temple because they think they're going to get something. There's no commitment in that. Plus, the influence of the emperor is growing, and the emperor will, by the time of Nero, halfway into the first century, the emperor has announced that he is a living god and needs also to be worshipped, and has started dedicating temples to himself. And this happens intermittently for the rest of the Roman era in the West. So this is a thing that is just going on all around. Pax Romana. The Romans have created us a peace. They have imposed a peace at the tip of a sword. They have imposed peace, which is primarily because if you get out of line with them, they just come and kill you. And the Roman perspective is you just need to kill enough people until there's peace. Once there's peace, you don't need to kill people for a while. But that's the Roman perspective. So this is military domination. This is enforced peace. This means that anytime there's a sign of revolt, that the Roman army comes and puts it down hard. This means that, you see the stories in Acts about, Theudas and these other guys that had revolted, and the Romans send, big cohorts of cavalry and, legions of troops to kill everybody. Because the Romans are all about stability. They're about economic integration. They're about a peaceable system where people can travel, goods can travel, money can travel, and so it's an enforced peace. And so the roads are safe for the most part. I mean, not completely, but they're generally safe across the Roman Empire, because whenever there's a big problem with bandits and that sort of stuff, they send the army. And they don't want to capture those guys and put them in jail. They want to capture those guys and crucify them on a hillside so that everybody can see it. So Roman roads connect everybody. All roads really did lead to Rome. The Romans built roads so that their military, so that their army could move fast and move far, that they could march troops wherever they wanted to. But those roads became the arteries of economic activity and travel. The interstate highway system in this country was built because President Eisenhower believed, based on his personal experience taking an army convoy across the country from the East Coast to San Francisco back before the First World War, that the America's roads were wholly inadequate to moving military forces in time of war. The interstate highway system, whenever you're driving along the interstate's highway system, you see that convoy of National Guard guys driving a whole bunch of green stuff. That's why those highways were built. It's their highway system. You're borrowing it. Okay? The interstate highway system was built in order to allow the military to move stuff from one place to another. The trucks, that's a side thing. And, of course, 70% of our economy moves by trucks on the interstate highway system. But in that sense, our interstate highway system is like Roman roads. It was built for military purposes, and yet it has big economic and personal impact. People could travel from place to place and move around. And you get on the interstate highway system, and you know that you can go hundreds of miles in a day and go wherever you want to go. So that's Roman roads. And then Roman justice. Romans believed in justice. That was, if you did the crime, we're going to kill you. If you maybe didn't do the crime, but you might have done the crime, we're probably going to kill you. If you're a problem, we're going to kill you. And we're going to kill you publicly and painfully so that others will be well motivated. So crucifixion, the Romans devised a means of execution that was incredibly painful and incredibly public. Paul wasn't crucified. He was a Roman citizen. Romans believed that crucifixion was such a terrible way to die that Citizens should never have to die that way. And so citizens were beheaded because that was civilized. Non-citizens were crucified publicly, and their bodies were left so that many people could see it. So this is the world that the church is born into. And these are things that are fundamental to who we are. So let's do one more. So let's think about this. And you can go ahead and build this one. So honor and shame are two big concepts. Go ahead and give me all those that run in this society and in this world. Okay, honor. What is honorable? What is worthy of honor? Okay, some of that's Aristotle, what is virtuous, but what should be honored? The Greeks believed that military prowess should be honored, that poetry should be honored, that philosophy should be honored, that art should be honored. The Romans believed that military prowess should be honored, that economic success should be honored, that being born into a good family was worthy of honor. So Romans and Greeks didn't see the same things as being honorable, but they both believed that certain things were worthy of honor. And you see some of this in the New Testament. Honor the emperor, says Peter. And shame. Shame was huge. You know, if there was something that you should be ashamed of, you needed to do something about it. If there was something that was bad about you, you needed to do something about it. So, these questions, dishonoring God, dishonoring ourselves, who is worthy of honor? Who is worthy of faith and glory? The hope of glory is for those who were shamed from birth, but now have this hope. Who are those who will not be put to shame? How do we then honor one another? How do we honor God as we go forth? This is an outline of Romans. Did you recognize that? This is an outline of Romans. Romans chapter 1 and 2, dishonoring God, dishonoring ourselves. Romans chapter 3, all have sinned, dishonoring ourselves. Romans chapter 4, Abraham. As a model. Who is worthy of honor? Abram's worthy of honor. At least Jews think Abram is worthy of honor. Let's talk about that. That's chapter 4. Chapter 5, chapter 6. Who is worthy of faith? Who is worthy of glory ultimately? How might I be saved? Chapter 7. We are shamed from birth, and yet we have the hope of glory. Chapter 8 and 9, he has chosen those who will not be put to shame. So what then shall we do? Chapters 11 and 12 and 13 and 14 are about how then shall we live. Chapters 15 and 16, how do we honor God in these things as we go forward? That's a way of thinking about the book of Romans that is embedded in the culture of the moment, where people were much consumed with the idea of, am I doing that which is worthy of honor? And is there something for which I have been put to shame? And so, when we come with the gospel, we speak to people for whom shame is a horrible, terrible, bad thing, and they need to find a way out of it, and for people who seek honor, to be honored, to live in ways that are honorable, to know what that means. And so, the gospel comes to this culture. That's still part of the culture that we live in today. The things that you are ashamed of are the things where you actually feel the need for redemption. And we are called today to treat one another with honor and to consider how we do that. In these days, how will you honor others? The gospel call is that we should treat one another with honor, all of us. So these are things that are foundations on which the church is built. This is the world in which the church is born into. So next week we'll talk about how did that come to pass and what does that look like and who are these apostle guys and what do we know about them and what therefore happened. So, and we'll do a turbo through the book of Acts in probably 10 minutes. We'll see. Anyway.